Good afternoon. So last time we started by talking a bit about connecting processors to memory and devices. You know, this is the idea that if the processors and the devices and the memory are all on this same kind of little communications network, then that means we can do this trick we call direct memory access, where a device can access memory directly rather than having the OS need to transfer data from the device and then copy that data to memory. We can have the device just do that whole process for us, and the OS just needs to tell the device where in memory to write things. Then we looked a bit into our out-of-order processor idea. So we mentioned this idea of doing out-of-order execution, that commonly in our pipeline processor, we found out that, well, we'd have to delay doing anything because the instruction we wanted to run next didn't have its values available. And a fix we can have for that is that, well, we can do the work instead as it's available. So if the instruction we want to run next isn't available, well, just move on. And we talked about sort of strategies for implementing this. We had this sort of one strategy we talked about, which had these kind of two steps. So our first step is that we wanted to like be able to figure out when is an instruction ready to run. We wanted to have a list of instructions that might be dependent on each other and somehow keep take account for those dependencies so you don't run an instruction when its values aren't ready. And a trick we used to do this was this registry naming idea, that we have a lot of real physical registers, and we use these once to write a value. And this meant for tracking whether a value was available, we just need to say, is the register available or not? Because it's only used once, we know if it's available, we have the right value there. We don't have to worry about, you know, some register we're reading from having different values, because this registry naming step is going to prevent that from being the case. We also saw that this registry naming idea gave us an opportunity that if we had complicated instructions, we could convert them to simpler instructions kind of for free, because we were doing this translation anyways of instructions. If we want to do some other translations, it's relatively simple to do that alongside. So once we did this registry naming, we need to actually run the instructions. And to run the instructions, well, we need to figure out what instructions we could run. So we just had this sort of table of what physical registers have their values ready. Then we'd scan our list of instructions in what we call an instruction queue, figure out which ones have their inputs ready, and see if we could assign them to our execution units. And we mentioned that we typically have sort of multiple execution units because we want to run more than one instruction at a time, including sort of starting more than one instruction every cycle. And often we'd specialize this. So rather than having something which can, you know, four things which could read memory or do an addition, we might have, you know, three things which can do arithmetic and one thing which can read memory, and hope that our instructions have a mix that sort of matches well to the actual execution units we have. So questions about the things we covered last time? Yes?
Why is it called an instruction queue if you can take out instructions in any order?
Why is it called an instruction queue if you can take out instructions in any order? So I guess instruction queue is the name I'm using, and as now I've seen in the literature, I would say it's because, sometimes in the literature, because I would say it's because queue doesn't mean it's a queue in any particular order. It's just the list a queue that's not necessarily in first, last in, first out order. Some writings about this will call what we call the instruction queue something like a reservation station or some other names that you might find more accurate. Okay, other questions? Yeah.
Does this queue have the same ordering as a regular program? Like we don't really add anything to the queue.
So the question is, what's the ordering of the queue? The queue does not have a fixed order. And we showed the instructions being filled in order, but there's no requirement to do that because the way we know whether instructions ready to run is based on whether its sources are ready, not based on where it is in the queue. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, so. So some anonymous feedback. So some mentioning that it would be nice if we mentioned more consistently whether an autograder was available. This is something I'll have to think about being clearer about next semester. I note that kind of one thing that led to this disconnect between students caring about the autograder and me is I expected that you would need and want to test locally because like debugging the stuff based on the autograder output is not meant to be possible. Like it is not a debugger. It doesn't give you enough detail for pretty much any of the assignments to actually debug things. So I assume that like it wasn't that important, but clearly students differ on this, and this is partly probably a bad habit for the assignments, given that you can't like really like add debug prints and run the debugger on the autograder test cases. So then concern about, we have this out of order homework, we haven't finished covering out of order stuff, and it seems like, you know, I really would like to have sort of the quiz results before I answer the homework. So I would say we're covering a little extra out of order stuff today, but the stuff for the homework we've basically covered. So hopefully that's not a big deal. I thought hard about whether I should make the homework deadline after the final review, but I really don't want to have to be cagey about talking about out of order on the final review, since you probably want to know how to answer questions about it on the final, other than by finding the exact rightly timed office hours to ask them. And speaking of this week's quiz, so this week's quiz, the first question covered something that's not out of order. Seems like a lot of people got it wrong. So I got the question asked, how much long after I leave the move did the add finish? And made a pipeline diagram. We learned that this conditional jump is mispredicted. And we were told in the question that when there was a misprediction, we fixed it. We figured out what to fetch during the execute to phase of the jump. So that's why I've drawn the fetch right there. And then I just counted cycles between the two instructions to get my, to figure out what the difference is between when the instruction's finished. Yes?
For the jump, why does jump's P1 not have to wait until it subtracts E2?
Why does it not have to wait until it subtracts E2? This depends on whether I phrased the question carefully or not. I see. So the question said the results of any jump are available then. My assumption was we had some machinery to like get the condition code computation done in one cycle. So the assumption would be that we have something here that happens at in the same cycle that does that. But that indeed was not clear. I will need to think of adjusting the key for, because it is reasonable to say, gosh, the conditional jump needs to do the work like we've shown before, and therefore saying that we would need to stall an extra cycle and shift everything over. So I will adjust the key to accept that answer too. Okay, other questions? Yes? Yeah. So the question is, why did we need to stall twice? So why did we need to forward here instead of forwarding here? And the problem is that this value here is from the memory, so it's going to be computed in the memory stage. Other questions? Yeah.
Is the condition code flags for the jump, is it computed during the subqueue or the jump?
Question, when are the flags computed? So they would be computed during the subqueue, because if we didn't run a conditional jump, we could still get those flags through other instructions.
Then why do we have to wait until E1 for the jump to determine whether having this direction predicted or not? Why can't we just...
So the question is, why would we need to wait for E1 of the jump to determine this? So we need to have the flags available somehow. And this is assuming, so that what I have written down that's not in blue is assuming that during the cycle the flags are produced, we still have enough time left in that cycle to do the jump less than equal based on the flags computation. And if that's not the case, we need even an extra cycle after that. Does that answer your question? But it's going to be computed by the subtract, but then we need to use them.
Why can't we forward from subtracting to the jump?
Why can't we forward subtracting to the jump? I am assuming that's being done here. Like, if that didn't happen, we would need to probably wait more. Because we need to have the subtract write the condition codes in E2 and then read them back in the jumps at some point in time for us to compute what to fetch. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so then on some of the out of order related questions. So there was a question about what instructions, you know, what sorts of instructions would we use what registers after we did renaming. And one of them was asking whether the add to R11 and the XOR to R11 would write to the same place. And with register renaming, the answer is no. They always write to different registers. They do overlap in registers in that the XOR will read where the add wrote. So we have this dependency here that is going to be reflected, but they're going to write to different registers, and we need that because we want it to be the case that if we have an instruction afterwards that uses R11, we want to write down that it needs X24, not X21, and have that information let us not run that instruction until after the XOR is done. So questions on quiz question 4. And on question 5, one of the options was asking if we could run the XOR and the add at the same time. And the answer is no. And this is maybe a little less obvious because it looks like, oh, the add we can run when 10 and 19 are available and it produces 20. The XOR we can run when 18 and 22 are available and it produces 24. Those registers are completely different. It seems like these don't depend on each other, so we're fine. But that's not the case if we look more carefully. And what we have to figure out is, well, if we want to run this XOR, what needs to happen first? And well, what needs to happen first is we need X18. Well, apparently that's computed earlier. We need X22, and well, that's computed by the subtract. So we need to ask, when can that subtract finish? And well, the subtract needs X20. Which add computes, so we can't actually run them at the same time because, you know, we can't start the XOR until the subtract finishes, we can't start the subtract until the add finishes, so it ends up being the case that the add and XOR have to run at different times. So questions? Figure that out. Okay. Other questions on the quiz? What does C read? R9. This is asking. I have the quiz here, don't I? No. Yes. So question 4. C. Why is which correct? C.
Why is C correct?
Why is C correct? So C is XOR will read R10 from the same register that add R9 R10 writes to. So it's saying that when we do this renaming, that the R10 value here will be the same register this writes to, and that better be the case because if we look at this assembly code, the value of R10 that's most recent is from that add because there's nothing in between which changes it. So it better write to register that we read from so we get the same value.
After the write and add, wouldn't the physical register that R10 actually
So the question is, wouldn't the add change it? Yes, so the add might do something, right? We will add, you know, so let's, you know, extend to some new register, let's say x30, but in that case, this down here has to be x30.
So the changing of physical register happens before the add?
So the question, the changing of physical register happens before the add? So the add will read from a different version of R10 than it writes to. So that's the new physical, that's the changing of the register map is because we're writing to a new version. So that happens as part of renaming the add. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so let's back to where we were last time. We were looking a little more at how these execution units worked. And we mentioned that often these execution units won't take just one cycle, they'll often be pipelined. And this means that we had this example of if we wanted to use this ALU that takes multiple stages, so it's arithmetic, but it takes three stages. If we're computing A times B times C times D, you know, we'd end up doing computing A times or C times D first. And then after that, we compute B times that, which would take another three cycles, and after that we compute A times that, so we'd end up taking nine cycles. But if instead we were computing, I'll write this in a different color, A times B and C times D and E times F, well, we could do those faster because it's pipelined. So we'd start A times B in the first cycle. Then in the next cycle, we'd start C times D and overlap it with A times B. And then in the final cycle, we'd start the last thing, and we'd end up taking five cycles for those three multiplies because they're independent. And our instruction queue logic of looking at what registers are ready is going to let us dispatch the instructions based on, you know, are they actually ready? And therefore, hopefully, if there's enough independent instructions, take advantage of this being pipelined. We also might have some execution units that, you know, take variable amounts of time. And that's fine because we can figure out when we set the register they're writing to as ready based on what the execution unit tells us. So for example, it's common for integer divide to be done in a way in the processor which takes a variable number of cycles depending on the numbers involved. So we could have some piece of logic that's going to output every cycle, am I done yet? And we'll use that to set whether the register is ready and determine whether we can send something else to this execution unit. As kind of an illustration, let's look at how, you know, the instruction dispatch might work when we have sort of this mix of types of execution units. So in this example, I'm saying I have three arithmetic units, ALU for arithmetic logic unit, arithmetic logic unit, and two of them can do add, comparison, jumps, and one of them does multiplies, and it's a two cycle. So it's pipelined, so it has a first step of the multiply and a second step, and we can start a new multiply every cycle, but we don't get the result right away. We have to wait a full cycle to get it. So if we're thinking about dispatching these instructions, we'll first, you know, find instructions we can run, and we're just going to go through each of these instructions and say, well, for this first instruction, is x1 ready? Yes. Is x2 ready? Yes. Therefore, I can run it. For this one, is x4 ready? Yes. Is x5 ready? Yes. And I'll say, then I can keep going. But if we look at our execution units, well, since I placed 1 and 2, I have to place 1 in the ALU that can do adds. And I have to place 2 in the ALU that can do multiplies. And now I'm out of slots to do multiplies. I don't have an ALU that I can start something in cycle 1. So I'm going to skip over instruction 3 because I can't run it anywhere. And then I'm going to look at instruction 4. I'm going to ask, is 3 ready? And the answer is no, it's not ready yet. So I can't run that. And I'm just going to go through all the remaining instructions and find out, well, can't run any of them, even though I have an extra ALU for additions, comparers, and conditional jumps. Don't have any suitable instruction to put there. Yes, I have an instruction I could run right now, but it needs to multiply ALU, and don't have one of those free right yet. So we'll run that, and notice that when I figure out what's going to happen to my instruction 2, I know it takes 2 cycles, so it's going to occupy the second stage of the multiplier in cycle 2, because I started in cycle 1. So then, we're going to, the instructions is ready, and we'll find out that, okay, since I finished the add, register 3 is ready, but register 6 isn't ready yet, because I didn't finish the multiply. So I can't do that. Can't you do anything that depends on register 6? And then I'm going to scan for instructions I can run. So I'm going to look at this first multiply here. Is register 3 ready? It is now. Is register 7 ready? Yep. So I can run this instruction, and I just put it in my multiplier. Can't put it anywhere else. And then I look at instruction 4. Is register 3 ready? Yes. Is register 8 ready? No. Instruction 5 can't run. Instruction 6. Register 3 is ready. Register 1's ready, register 3's ready, so I can start it. And I'll go through all the instructions and find out that, again, I can run 2 of them. And I know, based on having started instruction 2 in the last cycle, in my 2-cycle multiplier, it's going to finish this cycle. So after this cycle, we'll be able to mark register 6 that it writes to as ready. And similarly, I know that instruction 3 is going to finish next cycle. So then we go on to look for instructions we can run next, and we find out that, well, I can't actually, I can run, I scan what instructions I can do, so I've updated that register 6 now is ready because we just finished instruction 2, and register 8, which this third, this IMAL's writing to, well, it hasn't finished yet. It's finishing now, so it's still pending. I'm not going to mark it as ready. And I go through and do my same process. If I look at each instruction, say, is it ready yet? If not, can't run it, and look for as many as I can, and I find just 1. And I schedule that, and then I realize, oh, now the thing instruction 3 will finish now, so next cycle it's going to be ready. I can run instructions that depend on its results. And I keep going through this process, 1 step at a time, scanning through sort of my registers and come up with what I can actually run on my execution units. So you can see that we have to just take into account that some of our execution units takes multiple cycles and realize, okay, just because I started the instruction doesn't mean I can run things that depend on it right away. And realize that it's going to be ready a bit later. But otherwise, the process is the same. We maintain our list of what's ready now, what can I start now that depends on something, and use that to figure out what instructions I can dispatch, and we just have to pay attention to where can I put each instruction, because our execution units aren't going to be all the same. They're going to work for different types of operations. So questions? This procedure, yes?
We have a multi-stage ALU like the one we have here, like number 3, can we run them out of order as well?
If I have a multi-stage ALU, can I run them out of order? This is going to be a standard pipeline, so once I put something in it, it's going to come out a fixed number of cycles later. I don't have options to shuffle that around. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? So that's sort of the basic mechanics with running out of order processors. And something note is that, well, many of my examples of the instruction queue have shown that out of order processors, even though we might have lots of execution units and a big instruction queue, we have real limitations on how much we can run. And the biggest problem that out-of-order processors have that kind of limits their performance versus their theoretical performance is that, well, they can't always find instructions to run. Even though kind of a modern out-of-order processor is technically capable of starting 4 or 5 instructions every cycle, that usually is not even close to achieved because we run into these cases where we scan through our instruction queue and for many real programs we find out, well, not enough instructions already. We can't actually run 5 instructions this cycle. We can only find 2. This is especially true when we're reading values from memory, and we have hash misses and so on. So even though we might put lots of effort into having lots of execution units and a big fancy instruction queue, we often don't actually achieve kind of the maximum theoretical performance for typical programs. Some programs might get there, but a lot of programs, you know, it's a lot less. The other thing is that we need to track instructions that haven't finished yet. So this means that we can only go so far ahead, and we need to track it in the sense that we need to track it in what we call the reorder buffer. We'll talk a little about how that might work later, because we need to deal with finishing the instructions and freeing up registers, and we also need to have physical registers for each of our values. And, well, there's a finite size you can devote to this. So for example, Intel's Skylake microarchitecture, which is what my desktop in my office uses, has a 224 entry reorder buffer, so it can store information about 224 instructions that have been renamed but haven't finished yet. And it has 168 physical registers per core. But we can actually run into those limits, because that means that if we want to have, you have a load that goes really slowly, well, we can only go, you know, about 200 instructions ahead of it before we're going to run out of physical registers and have to pause until it finishes. And another sort of issue with these processors is that branch prediction, because we're doing so many instructions per cycle, and because our logic for tracking instructions is a lot more complicated, can have a much higher cost. So Skylake, it's reported, that the penalty for branch misprediction is around 16 cycles. Lots of instruction can be around 16 cycles versus 2. Because we have to go so far back and redo things when we have a full branch misprediction. It might be less if we can detect the branch misprediction sooner, but sort of published penalties are like, in the kind of our worst case, we could have this really big cost for a branch misprediction. So, talking more generally about pipeline processor performance, I'd like to get back to that issue of we can't always find work to do, and talk about this example I showed on the first day of class. You have these two loops that I said, they have different numbers of instructions, and they run at the same speed, same total performance. And now that we know how out-of-order processors work, we can explain what was happening here. And one way of kind of visualizing this is to kind of draw a picture of what the dependencies between these operations look like. So I'm going to take the loop on the right, and we can kind of picture what it's doing as it's taking RCX and RBX, adding it together, then adding RBX to the result of that, then adding RBX to the result of that. And we're taking R8 and R9, doing the same kind of sequence of adds. So I've drawn this picture where I have ovals or circles representing our kind of instructions, operations, and arrows representing when data goes from one to another. We learned in our out-of-order processor this happens because it's going through one of our physical registers, and the sort of where data comes to an instruction determines when we can run it. So we can kind of see visually from this picture that we have kind of three things the processor can do independently. So the reason why these two loops had the same performance is that the difference between the two loops was whether we had this thing in the middle or not. So as long as our processor could do three things at once, which it could, then we'd have the same performance. That it's just how long it takes to do whatever one of these three things is slowest. Now, if we didn't have enough capacity to do three things at once, then we would have experienced kind of a different performance for the two cases. And this sort of way of visualizing things is sometimes known as a data flow model, because we're showing data, how it moves through the instructions. And it's a nice way of quickly and approximately sort of figuring out how fast, when is going to out-of-order processor going to run things, because approximately what the out-of-order processor is doing is looking at these dependencies and running things as they're ready, subject to some limitations about just how much stuff it can do at once. some questions about sort of this visualization of these loops we saw, this loop we saw in the first lecture. So one thing we can say, try this exercise here. So let's say I have an execution unit that's a 5-stage pipeline for doing multiplies. How fast will each of these take? How long will each of these take to do the actual computation? Let's ignore the time for like fetching the instructions and all that. Just for computing the values, once we've loaded the instructions in the instruction queue, how long will it take? And we can look at our pictures of their dependencies to kind of visualize what's going on in each case. Give you a little time to. Would like some more time? Okay, so let's start with the example on the left. So who thinks that we could do this in 10 cycles? 10 or less cycles, sorry. 10 or less cycles? 11 cycles? Okay. 12 cycles? 13? 14? 15? 16 or more? Okay, so a plurality of people seem to say 15, that's what I get. And why do I get 15? Well, to do this, we first have to multiply RAX and RBX. We can't do it in another order because, well, all the other multiplies need us to get the value of RBX first. Or RAX, I should say, first. So we're going to do that first. That's going to take 5 cycles. And then after that, then we need to take another 5 cycles to multiply the result of that with RCX. We can't do the RDX multiply yet because it's not ready. So that's another 5 cycles. And then we have yet another 5 cycles. So we end up needing 15 cycles just for doing the multiplications. So questions on how I figured that out? Okay, so let's do the example on the right, which is probably the more interesting one. So who thinks that this would need 10 or fewer cycles? Okay, 11 cycles, 12 cycles, 13 cycles, 14 cycles, 15 or more cycles. Okay, so we have mostly 10 and some 11. So the reason you would get 10 is because you'd say, okay, we look at what happens here. We can do this and this at the same time. That will take 5 cycles, and then we do another 5, and you say 10. Now, there's a little subtle problem here, which is that the question is assuming we have a multiplier, sort of, this is not at multipliers. Seems we only have one. So since we only have one, we can't actually do those two multiplies at the same time. Yes, they're both ready at the same time, but we just don't have enough hardware to do them. If we had two multipliers, absolutely. But we don't, so we're going to need an extra cycle. So I would get an answer of 11 for that. And what's going to happen is we're going to do our A times B. We're going to start that first, and then we're going to do our C times D. And we can't start that the same time as A times B because we only have one multiplier. But we can start it the cycle after because it is independent. It doesn't need the answer. So we end up spending 6 cycles to do the first multiplies, and then we have another 5 for the last one, and that gives us 11 cycles in total. So questions on how I figured that out? Yes? This is assuming I can't forward stuff from the previous cycle to the next. So in order for us to be able to forward something, it needs to be computed, right? And my assumption is if we have a 5-cycle multiplier, we don't have the result until the 5th cycle. So I am assuming we're doing forwarding, but we can't forward early, because if we could forward early, we wouldn't say it's 5 cycles. Other questions over here? No. Yes, there. So the question is, if we were using this multiplier in our old pipeline processor, would this just be the execute stage? Yes. So if we were using this multiplier there, we'd have a five stages of execute. So we have fetch, decode, execute 1, execute 2, execute 3, execute 4, execute 5, memory write back. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? So finally, I'll talk briefly about what happens in the commit stage, in particular, sort of how we can mechanically deal with branch mispredictions and exceptions in this pipeline processor. That's going to have to do with our reorder buffer, which is responsible for, as I said, kind of finishing up instructions and cleaning things up. And a big reason we're going to have this is because, well, sometimes we need to kind of undo instructions that we've partially computed. And this reorder buffer is going to really help us with that. So I'm going to show you one way we can make the reorder buffer work. There are actually multiple different designs that real processors do, but I'm going to show you one way to give you an idea of what we have this commit stage for. So we're going to have this list of instructions that's in our reorder buffer. So we're going to have like a number for them, where they come from, what their destination register is, and we're going to have entries for if they're done and if they were mispredicted, or they cause an exception, like a page fault. And we're going to kind of add to the end of this list on rename and remove from the top of it when we commit instructions. And if we run out of room, well, that means the rename stage is going to have to wait until there's room. So we'll add instructions as we rename, and we have our mapping of physical to architectural to physical registers. I have this mapping in the wrong order. I'll get a note so I fix that later. And keep adding. And when instructions complete, we're going to want to get rid of them from this buffer. So as instructions complete, we'll mark them as done in our buffer. We'll also figure out sometimes that an instruction would cause an exception if it ran, or would be mispredicted if it ran. And we'll also mark that in this buffer here. But we're not going to act on that right away. And there's two reasons for that. So one is that if it causes an exception, we still need to finish everything before the exception. If a seg fault happens, we don't just not execute your program. Not a seg fault. If like a page fault happens, we don't just not execute your program up to there. The other issue is that if this is mispredicted, yeah, we don't want to run it, but we also might have a misprediction even earlier, so it doesn't run in the first place. So we're just going to record that and wait till we get to it later, because here we're looking at sort of the first instruction we haven't committed yet. So we're going to keep track of when instructions are finished. And we're also going to keep track of, for the first instruction we haven't committed, what is the mapping from architectural to physical register? So where is REX currently? And we'll see that this is going to be useful when we have a branch mispredition or an exception. And eventually, our first instruction is going to be marked as done. And in that case, we can commit it. So what we'll do is we'll remove it from the reorder buffer and also update our tracking of, for the instructions that have finished, where is RBX? So this means that now I can tell what the value of RBX is based on the instructions that have finished, ignoring the instructions we've started but not finished. And then we're going to check the next instruction, and we're just going to keep going. And we're only going to remove instructions from our reorder buffer when it's the first instruction and it's done. If it's not the first instruction, we're going to wait for the first instruction to finish. And if it's not done, we're going to just keep waiting. So eventually, we'll go through a bunch of instructions, and we'll have been updating our list of sort of the mapping from register from architectural registers to physical registers based on when we got here. And here, we have something special happened, that I got to an instruction that's changing the program counter, and it was mispredicted. I determined that we predicted it would go somewhere, and that was wrong. And that means that all the instructions after it didn't actually work. So we went to get rid of them. How can we get rid of the results of all these instructions? Well, we've kept track of where all our register values are going up to instruction 20. I have it right here. So what I'm going to do to get rid of the values from these later instructions is I'm just going to ignore those registers they're writing to. So we'll just copy our list of the current registers back to the mapping for the rename to use, to have the rename start over where the misprediction happened. So we'll just go back to where we should go and update our mapping of architectural to physical registers back to what it would be at the time of the jump, which we can just recompute this way. And then we can just get rid of all the other instructions and free up their registers for adding them to the free list. So the rename stage has registers available, and we don't bother running those instructions anymore. So this is kind of a high-level view of one strategy we can use to handle branch misprediction. And we can do the same thing for handling an exception. So like we have, if instead of this jump, you know, being mispredicted, let's say it caused a page fault, we just run everything up into the page fault, and then rather than continuing where the jump should go, we continue running the exception handler. But now we have all the register values, so the operating system, you know, can look at what was happening just before the page fault. So questions about this possibility for handling branch mispredictions and exceptions? And in particular, the important thing we're doing is we're getting the registers back to what they were at the time of the exception or branch misprediction, you know, so we can actually continue processing instructions, taking into account that we shouldn't have done a bunch of stuff we did. Yeah?
How does it know like what's the start of either the misprediction or
exception? How does it know where the start of the misprediction or exception is? So we're assuming that when we run the instructions in the execution unit, it's going to send a bit telling us, did this instruction cause a misprediction or cause an exception? And that's the bit we're checking. And we're just looking for the first time one of those is sent. Does that answer your question? Yes? Your question? Yeah.
What exactly does done mean when it finishes running?
So the question is, what does done mean? So by done, I mean the value of the instruction is in the destination register. And I'm deliberately not talking about how we deal with loads and stores here, because that's going to be an extra layer of complication. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so I've shown you kind of one strategy for dealing with this, dealing with these. There's other optimizations some processors do, like instead of reconstructing what the registers are, if we have a branch prediction, we could maybe have like a snapshot of it so we can restore it more quickly when we detect things are wrong. And in particular, this strategy, if we predict a branch and then predict another branch, if we discover the second prediction's wrong, we can't undo that until we get to the first one in this design, but we could fix that. It just makes things more complicated. So there's a bunch of other things we could do to make this better, but this shows you a strategy that works And it is pretty similar to what I understand most processors end up doing for exceptions, at least. Sometimes for branch predictions, they'll do things that are kind of optimized versions of this. Okay. So that's where I'm going to finish up on sort of out-of-order processors proper. So in our remaining time, we're going to talk about things related to the lab you did last week. So the lab you did last week, we had this check passphrase function, and we learned that because I was comparing character by character, you know, the time it took would be longer if I had more characters correct. So I could use this to figure out kind of what the passphrase was, just going character by character. So this problem is known as a side channel. So the check passphrase function doesn't tell us the passphrase starts with a D. It's not intended to do that, but it kind of did so by accident through this sort of, you know, non-official output, which is how long it takes. It's not meant to output how long it takes. It's just meant to give you yes or no, but if you time how long it takes, you find out exactly how that is. And this shows you why, if you're actually comparing passphrases or security-sensitive things, you don't use an equals routine like that. You have to write it differently if you want it to be secure. But there are other contexts where this kind of problem comes up. And so we're going to talk about a bunch of things related to side channels leading up to the famous Spectre and Meltdown, which are kind of a version of these side channels, but where the side channel is not going to be just timing. It's also going to involve the cache. And we're going to go up to there. First, let's talk about some more timing side channels. But first, I guess we should go through the simple one, sort of the protect passphrase. So questions on sort of how that works. So the thing you should have realized in lab is that, oh, it takes longer because we get further in our loop through all the characters if we have something more characters right. Therefore, I went to look for the longest time, and I can try character by character and just compare what the timings are. I can take multiple measurements to like get it consistent timing, because yeah, other things are going to be going on in the machine, but you know, if I keep running things over and over again, I'll get something that tells me something slightly longer once I sort of clean up my measurements. So questions on mechanics of what was supposed to happen in the lab. Yeah?
Can you explain again why it takes longer?
So the question is, why does it take longer? So in the check passphrase code, so we actually gave you assembly, but kind of the C code is equivalent to basically had this loop where it kept running as long as the first character I of the string it was comparing to in the real passphrase were the same. And when is that going to be true? Well, it depends on how many characters match, how long that's true. And to a first approximation, you know, how long it takes is how many instructions do we end up running. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So this kind of timing issue comes up in some other contexts, and some ones which are maybe a little actually scarier than the passphrase example. So one place it comes up is in cryptography. So in cryptography, a lot of especially asymmetric cryptography, public key encryption and digital signatures, involves big integer math. So like one thing you might want to do as part of these is multiply two 500-bit numbers together. And question that you might ask about is like, how do you implement multiplying 500-bit numbers together? Well, let's talk about doing something smaller. So let's say I want to multiply two 64-bit numbers together to get a 128-bit product, that's how big it could be, and I only want to use 32-bit multiplies. I want this to run in a 32-bit machine. How could I do that? And one way I could do that is I could say, well, my numbers are something times 2 to the 32 plus something else. You know, I can just divide them into 32-bit pieces, and I can do some algebra and realize that I can, you know, these are basically polynomials. I can take these polynomials, multiply them together, doing my algebra work, and find out that, you know, I can do this by doing a bunch of multiplies and then adding some results. So I can multiply the first part of each number, the most significant parts, the most significant and least significant parts. And, I see what I did here. And then the least significant parts, and adding those results together, and conveniently, these are, you know, I need a way of doing adds that are bigger than 32 bits, but that's a lot easier than multiplies that are bigger than 32 bits. So this is a simple multiply algorithm where basically what I'm doing is kind of like your, like how you'd multiply a big number by hand, dividing it up into digits. Here are my digits, instead of being, you know, base 10 digits, they're base 2 to the 32 digits. So questions on this way of multiplying? So we can extend this idea to work on bigger numbers. And you'll run into something interesting here, which is that if we kind of implement the general version of this, how many steps it has, that's going to depend how big our numbers are. So we end up leaking, if we think of the timing, it's going to take longer if our numbers we're multiplying end up being bigger or smaller past a certain threshold. So this idea for multiplying, it absolutely works, but problematically in these sort of asymmetric encryption or digital signatures, often whether the exact value of a number has, you know, 128 bits or 129 bits, that's supposed to be secret. That's not supposed to be something you're supposed to know, because you're not supposed to know the numbers that like come from the key. But we're going to leak that. And famously, probably one of the earliest attacks of this sort, some early versions of OpenSSL, which was a TLS implementation, very popular one. This is from work from 2003, had a timing attack. And the reason why is that they were doing some asymmetric encryption stuff, asymmetric decryption, I should say, and they had variable time multiplication and modulus operations. They didn't implement the multiplication algorithm I showed, but the multiplication algorithm they did implement was variable time, and same with the modulus. And how long they took depended on how the intermediate values were related to the private key. So like we computed some values using the private key, and what those values exactly were, how many bits they had, depended on how our input related to the private key. So this was a bit of a problem, because it meant that you could use this to do something like our check passphrase function to kind of figure out some bits in the private key. And they have this diagram from the paper here, where on the x-axis, they're showing how many bits we've guessed right of one of the parts of the private key. And on the y-axis, they're showing the difference in the timing for guessing it's 0 or guessing it's 1 of this operation that's kind of dependent on the difference between our input and the private key. And we have this thing that's measurable, and worse, it turns out to be measurable on, it turns out to take long enough that we could potentially measure it from a remote machine based on how long it takes. Like with our check passphrase, we are measuring like, you know, 10 cycles, 20 cycles. That's pretty hard to measure. Not like possible, but really hard. This was a lot more because it's big, complicated math. So that's kind of a problem. And what do we do to fix this? Well, if you're writing cryptography, you want to actually be very, very careful how you do these mathematical operations. You have to actually think hard about how do I make sure they take the same amount of time no matter what my secret values are. And this is one reason why I don't recommend implementing cryptography stuff yourself for actual use, because this is really subtle. People got it wrong for a long time before they realized that this was a problem. So questions on this sort of timing attack? Okay, so we've talked about side channels where the leakage is from kind of this way that the time takes a different amount of time. There's other sorts of things we can think of as these other ways of sort of unintended information leakage. And I'll give sort of, I think, one of the very simplest to understand examples that was really an issue, which was with web browsers. So web browsers, they run code on untrusted web pages, and you kind of depend on the web browser to not tell those web pages things about other web pages. So one thing we don't want it to be possible to do is that you shouldn't be able to go to evil.com and have evil.com figure out all the URLs you visited. You shouldn't be able to like get your web history. And, well, there was a problem here. So one problem, this was fixed in the early thousands. Notice in the early thousands that web browsers have long had this feature where they'll conveniently highlight whether you visited a link or not. It's a very useful feature. And an mostly unrelated useful feature is that if you're writing scripting code in a web page, one thing you might want to do is you wanted to figure out what color is this thing actually being rendered as. You know, how does, you know, we have these complex rules for setting out what the color of things are. Can I figure out what the color is? Yeah, you can. So both nice, useful, innocent features. The problem is that we could ask, hey, what's the color of the link to foo.com? Is it blue or purple? And you could automate this, and you could have a loop, because this is just scripting, this is just code, that checks like millions of URLs. Just have a page with a million links somewhere where no one's going to look at them, check all their colors. This is a problem. And you might say, how do they fix this? And the way modern browsers fix this is that they said, well, this convenient feature too is too convenient. And they deliberately broke it. So getComputedStyle, that function that tells you what the color of something is, it lies about links. It tells you the color it would be if it wasn't visited. And also, you can't set, you know, other, you limit, they limited how you can make visited links vary from unvisited links to prevent you from discovering some less direct ways. So this is another example of a side channel where the side channel is kind of our color information, you know, kind of revealing this secret information about what website someone visited. And another way we might have this kind of leak is with timing information. So something some people tried is, let's say you have a website open in your browser in one tab and an evil website open in another tab. The evil website can just see, you know, how often does it get to run? And it turns out that this kind of produces these patterns that are kind of consistent depending on what the other website is doing, because modern websites apparently do lots and lots of stuff, have lots of scripts running, so they have these kind of unique signatures of what activity they provide, so you can figure out if someone has New York Times open in some other tab because of all the stuff the New York Times sort of website is doing and the particular timing that has. So what they did here, these heat maps are just, they're running a loop and figuring out how many times does the loop run. The loop accesses a bunch of cache, so we kind of notice how is the other stuff, you know, using the CPU and the cache based on just how long things take. So we're kind of measuring just how much other stuff is happening and exactly when and what cadence. Questions on this kind of notion? Okay. So I've shown you some examples of side channels that kind of are, you know, kind of simple. We're going to go through something that's a little more complicated, and this is going to be with caches. So we're going to talk about side channels that, rather than being like timing directly, they're going to involve the cache in some way. Because the cache turns out to be something which causes variations in timing, that's interesting, and also often will encode interesting data. So let's say I time accessing a bunch of array elements, and this is the timing I get. So I get that it takes 3 cycles, 4 cycles, 4 cycles, 20 cycles, 4 cycles, 4 cycles. Well, I can infer from this something was different about array 192. And there's multiple possibilities, but a good guess is that maybe that part of the array wasn't in the cache, but the other parts were. It's not the only possibility, but often that would be why this would happen. So this can actually tell me stuff about other code. So something I can do is let's say I have an array that takes up the size of a cache, and I put access to all of the array, so it's all loaded into the cache. So my array's in the cache, then I do one other access, and then I check how long it takes to access each part of the array again. And I found out that, say, array of 128 is slower. So that meant that we had here array of 128 was in the cache, and here array of 128 was not in the cache. So what does that mean? Well, it means that the one instruction in between probably moved it from the cache. And that tells us something about where that was writing or in reading. So, a little time to think about. So what do we know about the other address based on this observation here? Who would like some more time? Okay, so let's start. Who thinks it has the same cache tag, A? Okay, some people. Thinks it has the same cache index. Thinks it has the same cache offset. Thinks it has a different cache tag. Okay, who thinks it has a different cache index? Thinks it has a different cache offset. Okay, so our polarity answer is that it has the same index and a different tag, and that's what I get. So why would it be the same index? Because in order to evict something in our cache, it has to map to the same set, the same row of the cache, which is based on our index. So we know that whatever other address is, it has the same index bits as array of 128. Now, the cache works in whole blocks, so we don't actually know anything about the offset bits, because we would have gotten the same accesses to the cache as far as, not accesses, but the same things loaded into the cache, regardless of where in the block we access something. So we don't know what the offset bits are. As for the tag, well, if the tags were the same and the indexes were the same, that would be the exact same cache block. We wouldn't have, other address would therefore be part of the array. But if it was part of the array, it couldn't evict itself, couldn't evict the same value, so it must be a different tag. Some questions on how I figured this out. Okay. So this means that we have this strategy here where we can run some code and figure out where in the cache it accesses things through this side channel. So sort of the code isn't outputting other address. We just look at what happens on the machine after it runs, after setting things up at the beginning, and we figure out, oh, this is where it was accessing memory. Well, some information about where it was accessing memory. And just like we saw that timing information could tell us useful things about secret data, we should be concerned that this is going to tell us interesting things about secret data, because sometimes the address we're selecting is not going to be something we're supposed to know. So if we're supposed to know other address, not a problem, but often we'll be able to run code where we're not supposed to know what that address is, but we're going to be able to find out a lot about it. So I've shown you this kind of general strategy, but first, some practical issues. So one thing that if you're thinking about, can I actually do this, you might be worried about is, well, our caches typically use physical addresses, but our programs using virtual addresses, that seems tricky to deal with, and yeah, it's a problem. But it turns out it's pretty tractable. So one thing we can do is, you know, sometimes the OS will just tell us what the physical addresses are, or we could do measurements to figure out whether things have related physical addresses, because like we can tell based on how long things take to access, like if they actually have the same index bits for our own values in our own array. And another thing is that often OSs like to allocate contiguous physical addresses for us anyways, because it turns out that many processors support a feature called large pages, where you can, rather than having a bunch of 4 kilobyte pages, you can have in a 2 megabyte page, and this is going to be faster to look up because we'll have less to store in the TLB. So often to take advantage of things like that, the processors will allocate contiguous memory. OSs, I say, should allocate contiguous memory anyways, or they just might by accident, because when we boot, if you're asking for memory, well, the simplest thing for the OS to do is just give you, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's not gonna choose random ones most of the time. So you might just get contiguous memory kind of naturally. Another complication is that our code that times things and processes things might evict things in the cache. And this is also a problem, but what we can do is we can kind of, test that separately. We can test, if I'm not doing accessing other address at all, what's slow, and compare that to accessing other address and make sure that's the difference. And in many practical scenarios, we can do this kind of comparison so we can eliminate that problem. Another issue is that processors do this thing called prefetching, where they try to guess where you're going to access in advance and bring it into cache early. So we might need to do some extra work to discourage the processor from prefetching. But that's something we can do by reordering our accesses and or using special instructions. Another issue is that some processors have caches, especially for the level 3 caches, where they don't actually use index bits, but they take the hash of a bunch of bits rather than just using the index bits directly. But we can deal with that if we figure out what that hash function is, or otherwise infer that things are in the same set. So these are problems that make actually implementing this in practice maybe more work than I'm suggesting, but it is possible. So we've gone over a complication. Let's go back to example here. So I have my access here. And let's say mystery is true. So let's just get rid of this if statement for now. So if I'm accessing, if pointer has this value and my cache is direct mapped, 32 kilobytes with 64-byte blocks, what array index should I be checking? And let's assume when I allocate the physical memory here that it starts at, a multiple of the cache size. I want to figure out I do want to have that there, sorry. We want to infer whether or not this access happened. Right, so we want to infer if mystery is set to 1 or 0, what is true or false. So should make that clear. So goal is mystery true. Anyone have sort of any ideas about, I guess, who would like more time first? Okay, a few people, okay. So first, figure out where should we check to see, so first goal, does this, where does this happen? That's our goal one. Goal 2, is finding out if mystery is true. who would like still like more time? So who, anyone can give me sort of what's the first step I should use to figure out where in the array I should check? So what do we want to be true about the index we look at versus the pointer? No volunteers. So if we go back to what we said here, we said that in order for us to detect an access in this way, we need to have a different tag and the same index. So we want to find part of the array which is going to have the same index as pointer. So I can think of how am I going to split out the bits of this value, and we're going to have a 6-bit offset in this pointer, and then we're going to have a 15 minus 6, 11-bit, so 11 bits is going to, 11-bit index. So the index bits need to be the same. So I can choose any value where those index bits are the same, assuming we disregard the virtual versus physical addresses problem. We assume that everything's a physical address, or the physical address is basically, offset by a multiple of the cache size, so it's not a problem. So in that case, sir, I'm going to check. So one possibility is I could check 188. Because that's going to have the same index and offset. And therefore, it's going to be the same index. And presuming that pointer and array are different places, which seems likely because we just allocated the array, that's going to be different tags. So the key thing is we want sort of same index and different tags. That's one possibility, and that will tell us whether the access to pointer happened or not. Questions? People, it looks like I'm not explaining this well. So basically what we're going to say here is that, if this happens, if it happens, part of array is evicted from the cache. So we're detecting that part of the array is evicted, and I just want to figure out exactly where it's going to be evicted. I just look for the index bits matching. Just construct an index with the same index bit, construct part of the array with the same index bits for the cache. That's going to be, we're going to see a longer time because something was evicted. So that will tell me if this access happened. So questions about that? Yes. Why is part of the array evicted? Because up here, the array is in cache. Array is filling the cache, right? So all of the cache is taken up by the array. So in order for anything else to make it into the cache, which we know happens because of how memory accesses work, something part of the array has to be evicted. Does that answer your question? So we're taking advantage, the array fills the cache, so something must be evicted. Okay, so that tells us the access happened. So next time we'll go over taking more advantage of this. And also, there's an interesting observation, if you're thinking carefully about this, you might make, is that I was asking, is mystery true? And that's actually a different question than whether the access to the cache happens because of branch prediction. Well, that seems like a problem, but it's actually an opportunity, as we'll talk about next time.